I know you've seen that Russia has unveiled a new class of nuclear missile, the Burevestnik, that has some additional capabilities. But Dmitry Peskov explained the reason why they developed it in the first place.
Russia последовательно занимается обеспечением собственной безопасности. Именно в русле этой задачи и происходит разработка новых систем вооружений, к коим относится вот озвученная система. Обеспечение безопасности для России является вопросом жизненно важным, особенно на фоне того милитаристского настроя, который мы сейчас слышим от европейцев в первую очередь. Европейцы действительно находятся в состоянии такой внутренней истерики, русофобской, агрессивной и воинственной.
Well, let's look at it from the standpoint of Moscow strategically right now. What is the situation? They are going to sign a peace treaty with Japan, and that's very important because it should have been concluded a long time ago. And that peace treaty is going to open up new avenues for both Japan and Russia. It's going to continue to sell its oil and gas to Japan and other things. At the same time, you have a whole set of agreements between Russia and China that are working beneficially for both parties. That is going to expand. It's not going to contract. Because for some time now, President Putin has concluded, as most of his countrymen, there's no future with the West. And so they have to build a different future in Asia. And at the same time, Russia has very good relations with Southwest Asia and the principal states of Central Asia, which are very important to them. So he's really looking right now at one dangerous front, and that's the front that faces Europe. But he also knows that if he's patient, he exercises some constraint, or I guess I should say restraint, that the governments that are plaguing him in the West are probably going to fall apart. That's certainly true in London, Paris, and Berlin. There's growing discontent. So there is, on the one hand, a recognition that these European governments at the moment seem to be incurably anti-Russian, but there's also a recognition that they are on very fragile ground, given the states of their economies and the financial system. So that leaves the United States. Well, what is the United States actually doing? Is the United States egging its European allies on into war with Russia? I don't think so. I think President Trump pulled back on the Tomahawks when it was made clear to him what the true state of our military readiness is. And I think he recognizes we're in no state to take on Russia in a war. Secondly, I think he also concluded there's nothing for him to win. He's not going to get a Nobel Peace Prize for anything that happens in Ukraine, because to do that, President Putin would have to surrender Russia's interests to us, and that's not going to happen. President Putin is going to end this war on terms that suit Russia. I think President Trump knows that. There's nothing he can do about it. And so he's effectively let the pot boil on the stove. Oh, yeah, we'll send more things down the line if the Europeans pay us, and maybe that'll help. I don't think so, is what he said, but maybe anything's possible. Does that sound like someone who wants to take a road of direct confrontation? I don't think so. Then in the Middle East, I think he is prematurely declaring peace, but, you know, that's at his risk. If the whole place blows up in his face, as I think it eventually will, he may regret saying a lot of the things that he has, but he's never really cared very much, because if you push him hard and say, well, you said this, he sort of waves you off and says, well, I meant this, and now I mean this. In other words, he'll change like a chameleon if he needs to in that regard. So that leaves us with Venezuela. Now, there's no question that we can muscle our way into Venezuela, that we can dominate Venezuela militarily, and for that matter, anybody else in Latin America. The only question is, does anybody care about that? In other words, we go in there, we do a lot of damage, we put somebody new in, and then what do we expect? The gold mines to open, the oil wells to pump, and, you know, we have eternal peace and prosperity for the rest of our lives. I'm not so sure that'll be the case. I think we're going to have a lot of trouble on our hands if we go in. But in the meantime, just the sight of U.S. military power dominating a weak country in the Caribbean basin, well, that's great. Great visuals if you're the president. These are my men. They're doing great jobs. They're the best. Nobody can stand against them. And I think everybody's told him very honestly, no, the Venezuelans can't stand up to us in that regard. So, you know, General Keane is wrong on Russia. I think President Trump has decided, I don't think I'll go to war with Russia this week. So I don't see that coming. You got to look at what happens in reality versus what is said. President Trump continues to say, oh, I'm really disappointed, and I think they ought to get this war over with. And, you know, we have a lot of capability, too. Let's not, you know, we can match what they do, and they know they should know that. Well, look, we can't, not on land. We can do a lot of things at sea because we're a maritime power. The Russians are not. But they've got a lot of submarines, too. And those submarines cruise up and down the Atlantic coast. They cruise up and down the Pacific coast. They may not be that obvious, but they're out there. They, too, can launch missiles. So telling everybody, well, we have submarines that can hit Russia with nuclear missiles is a dumb thing to say. We're very vulnerable to that ourselves. We don't have any integrated air defenses. We can't shoot down an ICBM right now. Now we're talking about an ICBM with, what, 8,000-mile range? It's hypersonic, but then again, all ICBMs are already hypersonic. That's why we can't shoot them down. So what has really changed? The only thing that's changed is that the Russians have a new weapon in their inventory for which we have no answer other than to engage in mutually assured destruction, which I think is something President Trump wants to avoid.
Let us hope that he does. You know, I want to shift gears here and one more zoom out, because I think that the bigger issue that at least I'm concerned about is not whether Secretary of War talks about how we can beat the Houthis or, you know, some other two-bit military players, but what would happen if we had to actually fight a peer or near peer? That's the absolute sine qua non of the measure of whether you have a great military power. If you can keep your country safe against somebody who has capacity, which is what you mentioned a second ago. And that is why your article got my attention here, because you're talking about some things that really matter here. And this is, by the way, is in our the description field for anybody who wants to go and read it, or you can just Google right there on responsible statecraft. But one of the first things that really stood out to me that I think everybody needs to get a sober understanding of is you wrote, quote, American military power is in a state of decline that will require a decade or more to reverse. Why do you say that?
Because there's a tendency in Washington, and I think sadly increasingly in Europe, to believe that if you throw great quantities of cash at something, that you're going to change it. Oh, we have a problem in defense. Well, we'll invest more money. We'll find some new weapon systems, and we'll be on track. There's almost no interest in the impact of what we do on the people that serve in the armed forces. We don't seem to really value human capital. They're saying now that we fixed the recruiting problem. I'm skeptical, but you know, certainly as soon as the economy crashes, you're going to see a lot of people that'll be very, very good, very smart, very capable, looking for employment in the U.S. military, and we should be glad that they do. But I don't see that happening immediately, but it could happen down the line. But even then, it takes time. It takes time to train. It takes time for technologies to reach a state of maturity, then to integrate those technologies with people, then integrate them within platforms, as the Navy is very platform-centric. They need different kinds of ships from the ones they have. It takes a couple of decades for even to make a dent in a new Navy surface fleet. But more important, we need a lot of manned and unmanned submersibles. In other words, we need more submarines than we've got. We've allowed the size of that fleet to diminish far too much. We have problems with people that are able to actually weld the steel on submarines. We don't have enough of them. It takes a huge amount of training and many years of experience to do it well. There are a whole lot of things. We haven't even talked about the integration of new electronics. All of this is overlooked in favor of throw money at it. But we don't realize that whatever we allocate today is not going to produce real military capability for perhaps 10 years. I came into the Army after the Vietnam War ended, but I came in while it was still going on at West Point. The Army I entered in the 1970s was a mess, and everybody who was in it knew it was a mess. And we were all playing catch-up, trying to recover from the squandering of resources and people in the previous 10 years in Vietnam. That took time. We recovered by the time you showed up in the late 1980s. Yeah. We were actually getting pretty good. I'm not going to sit here and blow smoke and say we were brilliant and the best there ever was and all this. That's a lot of nonsense. But we had come a long way, and we were getting very good, and we had gotten a lot better. Then we went to Desert Storm. And if you go back and remember, there, all these retired generals walked in and said, we're going to have 20,000 casualties. This is going to be a disaster. We shouldn't do this. Even Colin Powell initially said, let's just sit in Saudi Arabia, turn the border between Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Iraq into a new DMZ. And, you know, when I heard that, I said, my God, you mean we're going to be stuck in this desert in perpetuity? This is insane. There's no reason for it. Those of us who were where the rubber meets the road, who saw the enemy up close, we rapidly concluded we were not dealing with some irresistible force on the battlefield. We were confident. We had confidence in our people, confidence in the weapons, confidence in the organization for combat, in the things that we had to be able to do well. We went into that in a high state of readiness. We crushed the enemy in front of us. At the time, I thought we ended it too soon. That's another discussion for the future. But the point was, we were introduced into this at exactly the right time and the right place against an enemy who was completely unprepared to deal with us. We haven't seen that since, in the sense that what we did initially was almost incidental to what happened subsequently. Getting into Iraq was very, very easy. It goes back to the old statement, how long is it going to take us to get the 101st into Vietnam? And the four-star, Lemnitzer, said to McNamara, I don't know, not long. He said, the real question, Mr. McNamara, is how long is it going to take us to get it out? And that's the question that needs to be answered right now in Venezuela. If President Trump is smart, being the brilliant marketeer he is, whatever happens, he should declare victory pretty quickly and get out. Because the longer he stays, the worse it'll get. For all the reasons with which we are familiar. For the reasons we learned in Vietnam, the reasons we learned in Africa and Asia. Now, somebody's going to stand up and say, well, what about just cause? Remember that? This was going into Panama. And all of my classmates that were involved in that when we were majors or captains, they all said, we renamed it just because everybody concluded when they went in there that to get rid of Noriega, they didn't need to do all the things they did. They did more damage than was necessary, killed more Panamanian troops than was necessary. But fortunately for us, Panama was very small, very manageable. Venezuela is not. And those kinds of mistakes could have profound consequences for us. But I'm afraid there's probably no one in the vicinity of President Trump who's saying that. I hope I'm wrong. But we have too many people in senior levels that have learned over many decades, as you know, Dan, if you want to get ahead, there are magic words. They're called yes, sir. You don't bring up problems. You don't do that sort of thing. You point to it and say, sir, we can do it. It can be done. And then you go in there, no matter what happens, and you work real hard to make it work. And we know what that means. It doesn't work.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why we have the current chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Kane, because Trump bragged that he was the guy that he could get it done when everybody else said that it couldn't get done. I don't know what he's like now. I don't know what he's been telling him. I have literally no idea. He could be doing great work for all I know, but I know that that's something.
In fairness to General Kane, he was in an environment in the Middle East where he advocated the increase in the intensity of bombing and airstrikes. And that did have an effect. There's no question about it. Did we permanently defeat ISIS? I don't think so. Half of ISIS now seems to be an instrument of the CIA and the Mossad in Syria. Whatever. But the point is, in fairness to him, he was willing to step up the intensity. President Trump obviously liked that, thought that was very warlike. You know, Trump's always enamored of these Hollywood stereotypes of Patton and elsewhere, that he's looking for somebody, hey, this guy wants to fight, that's good. That sounds great, but if you go back through history, most of your best commanders frequently come back and say, no, I don't think we should do that. There's a better way. And they treated use of military power as a last resort, but they made damn sure when they did use it that it made sense.
Well, and that's what I want to go down the path in next. And this is something I thought was really useful from your article here, because you said something a second ago I think is really worthy of expounding upon. You said that when you came in the 70s, we had the mess that we had from the Vietnam disaster, et cetera. And then by the time that I showed up in the late 1980s, right before Desert Storm, we were in about as good a shape as we could be right there. So we had more than a decade of time to build up and recover so that when we needed it at that time, it was a solid force. We could have gone up against the USSR, which was still in effect at that time. And I think we'd have done quite ably, I believe. But here's the question now. Where we have been, and let's just say the last two decades, if we were to fight an unexpected war against a peer or near peer, whether that's China, North Korea, maybe, or certainly Russia, are we ready today to fight? And if we're not, what do we got to do to get there? How much time? And one of the things you wrote in that article, Gary, if you can put that one back up there, is you say that the key strategic challenges for Trump is not to meddle in Ukraine, the Middle East, or Latin America. And you said that his top priority should be to restore American economic productivity and prosperity, because that's the foundation that's going to set the stage for the military. So if President Trump thinks that there's a chance that we could fight against a peer near peer, seems to me you'd want to shed all of those things right now and focus on the things that you talk about, that 10-year period. What does that look like?
The lesson from the experience in Vietnam and the post-Vietnam restoration of the U.S. Armed Forces is that restraint now can create capability later. And that's really the argument. If we're willing to exercise some restraint right now, go back, re-examine what we're doing, re-examine what we've got for forces, then there's a good chance that over the next 10 years, we can be back in the position we were in 1989, 90, and 91. But nobody wants to exercise any restraint. Now, what does restraint mean? Restraint means a sobering self-assessment. Where do we stand? What do we need and what do we not need? No one in Washington wants to stop producing anything until you can find a substitute for it, because it means money. Money to them, money to industry, money to their constituents, and most important, to their big donors. The challenge in Washington is always the same. Keep the money flowing. Keep it flowing. Don't let it stop. Somebody like me who walks in and says, well, the first thing we need to do is we need to stand down X number of carrier battle groups. We need to bring the remainder up to full strength. Then we need to completely re-examine the shipbuilding program from top to bottom. We have to figure out what it is that we really need, not today, but in 10 years. How are we going to get there? Where do we extract the savings to get there? You have to have a new concept for what you're trying to do strategically. And then that filters down to the lowest level. This has been done before. The British went through this before World War I with their Navy. And you had some very smart people that made profound changes in the Navy. And the result was that the British Navy, the Royal Navy in World War I was really too strong for the Germans or anybody else for that matter on the planet to overcome. And that's really what they wanted. That helped them to eventually win. Of course, they won because we introduced a couple of million soldiers into the mix and we started producing everything for them. But at least at sea, they could not be challenged. So what are we going to do to get there from here? And at the same time, when you begin shedding these things you don't need and redesigning what you think you're going to need for the future, you need to invest very heavily in this thing called the private sector and prosperity. But you need a strategy. You need a strategy for high technology. You need a strategy for industry. You need a strategy for agriculture. All of this combined, along with a new national military strategy, is what you call grand strategy, which we've never really had. We've never really had it because we sat over on North America, the big island between the Atlantic and the Pacific, and we really haven't needed it. And so, you know, our big period of expansion that turned us into a major, major, major power is really between 1920 and 1970, that 50-year period, during which we had almost no immigration, very, very little. But what we did do is take all the various inventions and innovations that had built up over many years. We figured out how to assimilate them into the industry, into the private sector, and also into the military. This put us at a tremendous advantage, but we were not really engaged very much in the so-called interwar period. And when we did go to war in the Second World War, we went in with the largest manufacturing base in the world and the largest skilled labor force. we came out, and in what is nothing less than a miracle, we turned it all into commercial production. In other words, we were turning out dozens of bombers in the space of days because we built a tremendous assembly line. That assembly line literally collapsed overnight and started producing consumer goods. And it was very, very successful. That's all in our past now. We live in a different world today. We have to understand what is the world that we're in. How do we remain competitive? That leads you to very different conclusions from the ones that I think President Trump has reached. You know, do we need tariffs? In some cases, yes. Tariffs have always been an instrument that could be used defensively to protect things for limited periods. But we've tried to use it as a hammer. And he insists, even though it's not true, that we're winning this big tariff war. All we're doing is we're feeding the fire that effectively moves this giant locomotive known as BRICS further down the track.
Away from us, yeah.
Debasing our currency. It seems like a good answer in the short term to keep the dollar weak. But long term, it's a catastrophe. We don't know how much longer this can go on before everything collapses. So we need a self-assessment. We haven't done that, and not a realistic self-assessment. And we need a grand strategy, something we've never had. And we were lucky that things worked out the way they did in the past. You can't bet on luck forever. And right now, we haven't been so lucky.
Yeah, and of course, the problem with that is that makes everything you just said makes enormous sense, but it's logical, it's grounded in history, it's grounded in a forward-looking path should you have a grand strategy. But I think the fatal flaw in that is going to be nobody is going to bring that to President Trump because it doesn't have an immediate payoff right now. And what you're talking about is something you have to invest, something that's even beyond his term in office. And I don't see a whole lot of prospect that he's going to go down that path.
But Dan, let's be frank. You can't blame this entirely on President Trump. President Trump is very much a creature of the United States. I like to think of President Trump as in many ways the archetypal American. He has fully embraced the microwave technology as a way to do business. In other words, I'm coming up with this. The idea is in 6 months, we get this. In 12 months, we get this. The next quarter will produce this. Everybody on the Hill is very similar. That's why I said, if you go up there and say, well, we got to stop building M1 tanks. Yeah, we don't want to build any more Bradleys. We need a completely new technological path for the United States Army and Marine Corps. We don't need more of what we've got. So it's going to take us time. We're going to have to experiment. We're going to have to look at different kinds of technologies. Well, the congressman says, well, then what do I get for my constituents and my donors? How do I justify myself to them if you're going to cut me off from all this income that I'm accustomed to that comes from the status quo? Nobody wants to stop it. And this is not a new problem. You know, this is something for your viewers. They'll get a charge out of this. When World War II finally fell upon us like a ton of bricks, and we were fighting for our lives in the Philippines, where we lost the battle and 12,000 good men rotted in a prison camp for the next several years as a result, we still had 14 regiments of horse cavalry. Now, this is long after the Germans had overrun Poland, overrun France, overrun Norway, Sweden or Denmark and the Netherlands. They had driven the British 8th Army in North Africa hundreds of miles back on Cairo practically. So why were we still maintaining all these horse cavalry units? And I asked, well, why did we maintain them in the 20s? Why were we maintaining them in the 30s? I mean, surely mechanization was the path forward. Everybody figured that out. What's wrong with us? Why didn't we come up with Blitzkrieg? You know, why were the Germans the ones that developed this tactic? Why were we so far behind the Soviets? Because they had produced thousands of tanks and they were experimenting. Well, there's a reason for it. It's called horse manure, because tens of thousands of horses all over the West produced vast quantities of manure. The manure was scarfed up, packaged, and sold to farmers all over the Midwest and the South. The horse manure business took precedence over the United States Army and its needs for modernization. So when you ask the question, well, surely when Douglas MacArthur was chief in 1929, or Malin Craig was chief in 1935, or Marshall was chief in 1939, why didn't they wave their hands and say, get rid of all this horse cavalry? Well, now you have the answer. It was a lot of money in horse manure.
Well, and there's a lot of different kinds of horse manure that's going on today that's keeping us from getting to that kind of a modernization that we need. I just hope it doesn't come at too high of a price in the future. We've gotten lucky, as you said. Don't know how long that luck is going to hold, but at least we now have visibility from what you've given us here today. There is a path forward. There is a way to get it done. We just have to hope that somebody will put you in a position of authority one day and actually act on your judgment there. That's what we'll have to hope. But in any case, we appreciate you coming on and sharing this today, because people can't say they didn't know in the future.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Dan.
And we appreciate you guys, too. Be sure and like and subscribe if you haven't. Also, a reminder, please let your friends know who may like to get their information via podcast. I know a lot of folks really like that. Tell them my Apple Podcast, Spotify, Podcast Addict. Type in Daniel Davis Deep Dive, and they will find us wherever they get their podcast, or DanielDavisDeepDive.substack.com, where you can find us in the written version there. So we actually also have some videos on that. But anyway, you can get, once your information, we've got it for you, because we are unintimidated and uncompromised to give you the truth that you need, and however you want to get it, it's there waiting for you. Thank you very much, folks, and we'll see you on the next episode of Daniel Davis Deep Dive.